Thomas Paine podcast, the big podcast, Big Wednesday podcast, number 33. Got a little bit of everything for everyone on this one. It's really amazing how these things come together. We're really working on shoestring budget down here and everything else, and they seem to come together nicely. I guess we're doing something right. We'll be breaking some news today and making some news today like we usually do. Before we get to that, we'll talk about the Thomas Paine mini tour of America, where we departed from Philadelphia and made our way to southern Florida, and what we saw in between those points, and what Americans along the eastern seaboard, south of New York and Philadelphia, think about this CoronaCon, this scamdemic. that should give you a hint as to what they actually think about it. And it's the insights are amazing, and we're a little worn down because we came back on Monday. It's okay. Really, Tuesday, by the time we got back, and driving. We drove down. We didn't fly down. You can't figure out anything when you fly. You got to get in these small towns and talk to people. See what's happening in different states. Observe, document, like a sponge when I go out on the street. It was like a sponge in a lot of those places, 98 degrees, 100 degrees. You're like a sponge. Woo! Before we start, just want to say thanks to the folks on patreon.com/truepundit and subscribestar.com/truepundit. They get to see the Pain in the Morning podcast via video podcast, and also the More Pain show we're coming off of doing Tuesday nights. That was a good one. We will expand on some of the issues we spoke about here today from Tuesday night. And we waited to put this out for a while on Wednesday because I was waiting for intelligence to develop, and that usually is the case. So we appreciate the direct support on those platforms. It does go right into helping us do what we can do, and also helped us go on the road, see what was happening. We'll be breaking some news here in a bit on Mr. Hollander, Roy Den Hollander, the alleged gunman and men's rights attorney who is suspected of being the gunman who shot the husband and son of federal judge Esther Salas at the family's home in North Brunswick, New Jersey, before allegedly killing himself. Sure, you can read all these official narratives in the media. This happened, that happened. The guy was like a disgruntled attorney. But and then you can talk to somebody who knows what the hell's going on. Really shed some disturbing light on it. I think you'll find the intel that we've developed beyond disturbing. And again, like last week, I anticipate that the story will take off because you can't even make it up. And we've broken a lot of these Epstein related stories. Suicide of Deutsche Bank and Citigroup private wealth banker Mr. Bowers, and he was Epstein's private banker, both of those institutions, and his untimely death during the holidays around Thanksgiving. We broke that story. the FBI agent who worked on high-profile cases involving the Clintons, South Cincinnati, broke that story, his suicide. Of course, Epstein's suicide. Now Maxwell's in prison. If you were a betting man or a betting woman, you would say she might be next on the list. She thinks she is. She said this week she thinks that she's on the list to be handled. And this judge Salas had been assigned to case dealing with Deutsche Bank. How they handled their money and how they failed to put the proper guidelines in place. So we continue to connect the dots at the True Pundit and on the Thomas Paine podcast. And we are ahead of the pack as usual. And this is just another link in the chain that you may find as disturbing as we do. Are we really supposed to believe this official narrative they cooked up, that this guy dressed as a FedEx guy, delivery man, went to the home of this judge, right? Shot the husband, shot the son, killed the son, then left, then killed himself somewhere else. Are we really supposed to believe that is what happened? Okay. I mean, I highly doubt that's what happened whatsoever. And when you listen to the information that we've developed, I think you will agree. And we will get there in a matter of moments. But that official narrative, so to speak, that was cut loose in the media long before the facts had come in, certainly doesn't make any sense as far as organic crimes go, killing sprees and things like that. If the judge was the target and she was home, how does she survive? And we've talked about it last night. It could have been a message somebody was sending her. Sure. I think this is when you take a look at all the evidence. I think what you're going to see here is that this is a case about money. Rich people, very wealthy people's money, and what they did with it at Deutsche Bank and other places. And I want to keep a lid on that. And she's the judge now, presiding on over a case about exactly that, tied into Epstein and Maxwell using Deutsche Bank's as a financial backbone to run trafficking schemes of children and worse, sexual assault, etc. We all basically been briefed on the ABCs of that entire case, but those are just two people. Those are just Epstein and Maxwell. What about other people? And we're going to get into that. Matter of moments. We're going to keep this one short. We're going to stick and move on this one. So buckle up. I think we'll probably go for about an hour, maybe a little bit more. I don't know. But I want to get this out there on Wednesday night. See if it can pick up some steam. And before that, I want to share with you some of the insights we had for a lot of the folks who have been confined to their house, like common federal criminals on house arrest, minus the ankle bracelet. Although in Kentucky, they slapped the ankle bracelet on a couple who wouldn't sign the "I promise to stay at home, I promise to self-quarantine." They wouldn't sign the paper, so sheriff showed up and slapped some ankle bracelets on them. This is the insanity of what's going on in our country, but you'll see for yourself here that when you take a peek outside of what's going on outside your door, outside your city, outside your state, that a lot of people are not buying this, and they're biding their time, and they've been patient, but I think the patience is running out. And let's get into that right now, and then we'll get into Mr. Roy Den Hollander, some of the incredible things that, for some reason, just everybody else in the media has failed to report, just, you know, suspiciously, the mainstream media. And I'm sure when we break this stuff, the right-wing media will sit on it too, but, that stuff's way too hot, man, we can't touch that. So without further ado, let's talk about our trip. One of the things you notice when you're traveling around the United States now, at least we noticed, was not a lot of people are wearing masks, not because they are afraid of the virus or anything like that, just because they don't believe that there is an imminent threat. And a lot of the people I talked to, I spent time with talking to in different locations, from South Florida to Northern Florida to actually all throughout Florida, to be honest with you, and especially in Georgia. In towns where there were mandatory mask orders, like Savannah, and in places like Folly Beach, South Carolina, mandatory mask order. No one is wearing masks. And you ask them, they're like, what? What are you talking about? This is not a pandemic, so. And then you weigh that with the fact that as the mortality numbers go down and the fatality numbers go down, while they're trying to pretend that the numbers are up because testing is up, and then we learn that all the numbers are fraudulent and fake and doctored. Now they're pushing the masks, these bureaucrats, state, local, and federal. Now they're pushing the masks. We're past the point. You should have been pushing fucking masks if you're going to push them in April, in March. Okay, the curve is flattened, and these guys are holding onto the curve with like both hands, are clinging onto it, right? Like a cat hanging from a ledge, because this is their way to keep their foot on your neck. This mask situation where they can sell fear and make you feel like there's imminent fear and disaster, your fellow man. You can't talk to your fellow man about anything that's going on. You can't smile. You can't. It's really fucking sinister. The whole thing is definitely sinister. So it was refreshing in places like Georgia and Florida where you could actually have conversations with people and they weren't afraid of you like you were Typhoid Mary. People get a little bit more tight-assed and high-strung in Virginia. In North Carolina, South Carolina, not really, pretty laid back, but in Southern North Carolina, along the same lines. Although on the way back through Northern North Carolina and Virginia, I noticed that less people were wearing masks and concerned about social distancing in stores and things like that. We went to get food and bars, so. But the government, they want to keep their foot on your neck, keep you down, keep that mask on. And you see disturbing images and rhetoric coming out of the White House now along the same lines. And if you're like me, you're scratching your head like, what is going on here with these masks? And so the one takeaway from the trip, and I don't want to make this seem like you're watching somebody's slides from their vacation. It wasn't really a vacation. It was a work road trip. The one takeaway is people think this is a scheme. They're not listening to the bureaucrats that tell them to wear a mask, do this, do that. They're just simply not listening because they don't believe in it. And that's refreshing because the media is not giving you that perspective. The media makes you think everyone's wearing a mask, everyone's abiding by the laws, everybody's playing their part. You see these signs through the Beltway. They have all these signs on the highway in 95 and 495 on the Beltway. Do your part. Wear a mask. Like, you know, they have the digital signs that alert you to, like, oh, traffic jam ahead 2 miles. They all say, do your part, wear a mask. And then we come back and we start to hear the same type of messages this week from the White House. And I'm saying, what the fuck is going on with these people? I'm not wearing a mask. The states will start, I think, to clamp down on it now and make it a crime and things like that because they want to keep their foot on your neck. This is about control. This is about fear. That's all it's about. That's all it's about. The haves versus the have-nots, I've talked about it. I'm fucking actually tired of talking about it. I'm not sure anybody listens to what I have to say about it anyhow. But I'm going to continue to stay focused on it, even though it's like banging your head against a wall. This is definitely an operation all the way through. And now, well, that's a topic for another day. Gates and his vaccines being welcomed with open arms in the White House. We'll get to that later. There's enough going on here. So people from both sides of the aisle understand they're being played. But they also understand they can't do much about it. We're all in the same boat together. The have-nots can't do jack squat about this. For the time being. Eventually, if they keep pressing, based on world history, there's going to be serious fucking pushback, I think. I would be very surprised if there wasn't. But also, there's a growing part of me that understands there might not be that pushback. People might just go along and get along. That's not going to be me. We were supposed to stop at a COVID-19 checkpoint when we got into the state of Florida. And I said, fuck that. We're rolling through. We rolled right through this like roadblock thing they set up. I said, I don't stop in my country to give people my papers when I haven't done anything wrong. And I'm not going to play that game. But there were plenty of people, hundreds of cars, thousands of cars, I guess, through the day that did. Pulled over and you got to give people your information. And I guess they shoot your temperature. Fuck you. I'm trying to get somewhere. I'm driving 85, 95 miles an hour. You think I'm going to pull over for your bureaucratic ass? So you can you can track me? No, I don't think so. That's not the way I'm going to play it. So no matter what happens here, and how much they clamp down on people, I'm not playing that game. And I think you would be well served to follow the same example, the same lead. Don't let these people push you around. Don't play games with these people. Ignore them as best as you can. I understand it's getting more and more challenging, but that's just me. And then, you know, so it was a worthwhile trip. Because this stuff, none of this stuff is in the media. None of it. None of it. Right? You're going to bars down there. They're jamming. We're having a thunderstorm right now, so if you hear that noise in the background, it's Wednesday evening in Philadelphia. Finishing this up late because information was coming in late. It's all bullshit. I'll give you a quick example before we get into the situation with the shooter, the gunman of the federal judge's family. A DEA buddy of mine sends me a note. I'll just read it to you. Let's see. Let me call it up. And I've seen this theme play out several times this week in news coverages throughout the world, actually. Not just the United States. And the United States. Our neighbor, who is a nurse on the front lines with COVID-19, has two aunts in South Carolina. They always schedule their annual checkups with their doctor on the same day. This year, the doctor wanted them to be COVID tested before their appointments. They showed up for the COVID test. You can't even believe this. And there was a long line, so they left and didn't do it. Subsequently, they canceled their doctor's appointments. The doctor calls them the next day and states their test came back positive for COVID. Yet they never took the test. Can you say scheme? This is why you don't. I've said this about the couple in Kentucky who they slapped the leg irons on because they wouldn't self-quarantine. And they wanted to go, they voluntarily went to get tested. My philosophy is unless you're running a 117 degree fever and you think you are in serious situation, do not go for voluntary tests where you then become on these people's radar screen. And I'll tell you what's going on here. they're saying, oh, yeah, you're positive for your test, and they put you on a list so they can come barreling into your house at any time they want with these contact tracers and harass you, even if you haven't been tested. See, that's what's going on. They want to have the ability to come barreling into your home, and in many states now they have the legal precedent, quote-unquote legal precedent. Some politics, I'm starting to get fucking frustrated. Some politician's tyrannical edict that these people can do this. It's nothing to do with legality. People like Cuomo in New York, people like Murphy in New Jersey, people like Wolf in Pennsylvania. And the list goes on and on and on and on and on. So that's what's happening out there. And you're going to watch these tyrants. If they feel that they're losing control or they're losing their grip on people out there, and at least on the Eastern Seaboard from what we saw the last few days, they are. Then they'll just start making these things mandatory. Then if you don't do it, then you get some kind of a situation where you're arrested, stuffed, cuffed and stuffed. My question is, are people going to just sit around and take this like a bunch of fucking pinatas? Because if you are, then you deserve it. You deserve to lose your country. That's how I see it. The folks who want to stand up and have been standing up are in the minority. Folks that are speaking out, shining a light on this insanity, unconstitutional, tyrannical insanity, communism, are in the minority. We need more people. Get the fuck off the couch. Get in the game. Or when it's all gone, don't piss and moan to me and to other people. I have to be honest with you. I've gotten some scathing mail lately. Like, you're saying this, and you're saying this about the White House, and you're saying this, and you're part of the problem. And all this stuff, and my response to a lot of people is just, what the fuck have you done in the last 5 months but sit around and bitch? Have you done anything? Have you? That's what I say to them. Don't fucking jump out with me. I'm out here every day hustling, trying to shine a light on these fucking criminals, these vagabonds, and these politicians who are stealing your civil liberties on a daily basis. What the fuck have these people done? Most people sitting out there. I tweeted about this. This is bullshit. What have you done? That's my response. And guess what? No one ever writes a response back. Now, there are people. I have listeners and viewers and whatever the hell you want to call them, readers and the different platforms we have now, who are active. Okay? It's not directed to those folks. I'm talking about people, you know, casually they think, oh, yeah, you're full of a lot of hot air. You're having, what have you done? You've done nothing. So my message is very simple when it comes to that kind of stuff. If you do nothing, and this keeps growing and persisting and getting larger and larger and larger, when it's all done, and the country's been turned upside down, and it doesn't even resemble what it was just a matter of months ago, whose fault is that? While people sat around. Okay, let's move into this Roy Den Hollander, the suspected gunman who shot the husband and son of federal judge Esther Salas, according to law enforcement. And don't worry, the FBI's investigating, so they'll get to the bottom of it. Of course, you'll never know what the hell they found, and they'll try to keep as much as they can secret, but they'll get to the bottom of it. It's none of your business, just like they got to the bottom of the Las Vegas massacre, Mandalay Bay. Yeah, none of your business. Nothing to see here. Move along. Before we start and get into this portion of the show, I think it's important to note that during the time frames involved in the story that's about to be told about Mr. Hollander, I was working for the FBI And I was also working with or for in one form or another. At that time, Mr. Hollander's employer, Kroll Associates. Pretty big firm at the time, and still is. So I might have some expertise in this matter based on contacts and wherewithal. So let's go into this, okay? Let's go into the official story is this guy had some kind of, he was a lawyer, he had some kind of beef with the judge, the federal judge, and he, from 5 years ago, having to do with an old case that he was working on. And he went, I'm checking my texts because information always comes flying in here late. And it could have something to do with this. So, and that he had a beef with the judge that was 5 years old, blah, blah, blah. And then he showed up at the house and something about explosions in New York City. Wow. Let's follow up on that. Showed up at the judge's house. Because he had some kind of grudge against her. And ended up shooting her husband who opened the door. And then the son came down to see what was going on. And then he shot the son and killed the son. And then he left. Mr. Hollander supposedly left. And he was dressed as a FedEx delivery guy. And then later on, he was found dead by suicide. This is the story that they're trying to sell. So, let's look at his resume. It's very interesting. It pretty much tells the whole story, but his education, this is no dummy. MBA from Columbia U in New York. JD from George Washington University School of Law with high honors. Folks out there know what George Washington University is? It's a lot of high-placed folks in Intel come from George Washington University, and that's where you make a lot of contacts. And if you're going to law school there, a normal transition is to go to, from law school into the government or into government work. And I think that's exactly based on the information we have developed on Mr. Roy Dan Hollander is what he did. So he was a lawyer and a business consultant working for several private clients through the years. Most notably, we're interested in his time in Moscow, Russia, between about 1998 and 2000 or 2001. He has listed, and we've confirmed that he worked for Kroll Associates. Again, they were a former client in one way or another through subsidiaries and other cases that my group worked on at the same time when I was a contractor. So this guy was working in Russia for Kroll, and he managed and promoted Kroll's intelligence and security delivery in the former Soviet Union. For folks who are not really familiar with Kroll Associates, they're considered by many like a private CIA. I think they've been, at the time that we were working in the same arena, they were dubbed the private CIA. And you'll see why as we move on here. Hollander was working in Russia prior to his employment with Kroll as an attorney, representing different... it's all kind of mysterious, kind of dark. Nobody really knows what the hell he was doing in Russia. And you... You'll come to figure out why. When he took this job with Kroll, he was the... we'll get into that, but he replaced a guy named E. Norbert Garrett And Garrett is a well-known CIA, former CIA, and he was a big wig in Cairo and Kuwait and the Middle East and station chiefs in those places and other places, according to well-placed folks. So he moved on, we believe, to another job in Kroll. And then Hollander came into Moscow and took his place on behalf of Kroll. Now, Kroll, at the time, let's lay out the landscape of what happened in Russia. And Kroll was actually in the country investigating Russian banks on behalf of, guess who? Deutsche Bank. Yeah, it's true. And Deutsche Bank, to take you back to what's going on here, the shooting of the husband and the son of Esther Salas. She was recently assigned to oversee the Jeffrey Epstein Deutsche Bank case. Okay. Now you're telling me that just out of nowhere, the gunman, alleged gunman, I don't really think that he I don't think that he is responsible for this, but, you know, that's just me. But the alleged gunman also had worked for Deutsche Bank and coordinated with concerns like the Central Intelligence Agency when he was running the Moscow operation for Kroll Associates. So you have a direct ties to Deutsche Bank, and we'll get into that in a minute, and you have direct ties to the CIA. And probably, by default, FBI. But the former two are big enough without throwing the FBI. The FBI is like a small player here. Okay. What was Kroll doing in Russia at the time? Let's take a look at this while you digest the fact that this guy was there working on behalf of Kroll and Deutsche Bank, and also the Russian government. At that time, Boris Yeltsin was running the show, and he wanted to bring Kroll in too to investigate what was going on in Russian banks. And across the way with former KGB strongman Vladimir Putin, but we'll get into that in a minute. At the time, we're talking about 1998, 1999, 2000, 2001. Russia's financial institutions were all in trouble. There was a massive bank crisis there. The Russian banks were facing widespread bankruptcy, and they were preparing for a stream of lawsuits from Western partners and banks and financial institutions. I forget what, somewhere between $40 billion and $60 billion they stiffed from financial institutions in the United States. And we'll run it down here as we speak. I'm just trying to throw all this at you. This is raw intelligence that's coming in, so you kind of have to put it all together, and may seem jumbled, but that's the way it is when the intel comes at you raw and it's fresh and it's good. Russian bank customers, most of whose accounts were frozen because there was a run on the bank's money. And moreover, the banks in Russia owed billions to other banks, including Deutsche Bank, including Lehman Brothers. In fact, at the time, Deutsche Bank and Lehman Brothers filed suit against Russian banks to try to recoup their money. Now, what was Hollander doing? Hollander was brought in with Kroll to find where these Russian banks had hidden their money so that Deutsche Bank, Lehman Brothers, and a handful of other banks could recover funds. And Kroll was able to find numerous offshore bank accounts that were opened by former Soviet and Russian executives and members of the party, the Communist Party. They were squirreling money away. They were hiding money away. So you have Deutsche Bank, who had sued the Russian banks, again, along with Lehman Brothers and other financial institutions. And Kroll was working on behalf of these guys and feedback, back channeling, front channeling, however you want to say it, information to the Central Intelligence Agency, because Russia had stiffed the United States for billions at that time. Russian banks, and we're going to talk about that. So let's just break this down. You got the CIA. They want information on what's going on with these banks. You got Deutsche Bank, and you got the guy who's the leader of Russia at the time, Boris Yeltsin. He also was paying Kroll Associates, and Hollander was running that too. Okay. They all wanted to know, all these people wanted to know where all the money went, because they were trying to get a clawback, try to get as much money recovered from these banks that were going belly up. They had billions in outstanding loans and instruments, and they wanted to try to recoup as much as they could. So you have all these people looking for money, and it was paying off. And Hollander's over there in Moscow, the guy, the alleged gunman, working on behalf of these banks, and Kroll and the Russian government. There's no such things as coincidences when it comes to this stuff. I'm sorry, I don't believe in them. Happenstance is for suckers. You tell me this guy Hollander was working with Deutsche Bank, the Moscow arm of Kroll Associates, he was running. He was also being paid by Boris Yeltsin, the Russian government, and they were coordinating information and intelligence and swapping information and intelligence with the Central Intelligence Agency. You tell me this guy, this is the guy that shot the federal judge's kid and the husband? Yeah, okay. Right. This is a guy that you'd want out of the way if he found a lot of stuff out that he shouldn't have known back in the day. And when it comes to Deutsche Bank and bank accounts and things like that, isn't that what the federal judge is working, the case is working on now? Now, you could go crazy with this and connect all kind of dots and, oh, this must mean this, this must mean that. And it could get crazy, right? To me, what's crazy is the fact that none of this has been reported, which means I know other people know about it. They're just clamming up about it. So they were like, we're just going to start spitting out raw intelligence at you, and I'm not really worried about how pretty it looks. you can keep up. You can listen, go back and listen to this. So Deutsche Bank was the leader at the time of about 16, 17 banks, a consortium, so to speak. And Deutsche Bank was leading and pressing to try to find the assets of these banks, and also pressing the Russian government to offer better terms to holders of the defaulted bonds. The Russian banks stiffed these people. That includes like U.S. hedge funds and other folks who had invested in Russian debt, so to speak. Everybody was fighting for a seat at the bargaining table, trying to line up. Basically, you're in like a rich man's breadline, trying to get put yourself in a position to recoup as much money as you can. At the time, here it is, Moscow had defaulted on $40 billion of U.S. bonds. And that's why the government was involved in seeing what the hell was going on. That's why you have operations like the Central Intelligence Agency globally, and that's their task to find out what the fuck is going on. And then you have the CIA working with Kroll, which is no big deal, because a lot of guys from Central Intelligence Agency and DOD and NSA and FBI would leave their careers and parlay that into a career at Kroll and do the same thing for much more money. So you have the CIA working with Kroll. Kroll's working for Yeltsin, and Kroll's also working for Deutsche Bank and this consortium of 17 banks that, again, was led by Deutsche Bank. And Hollander, the gunman, allegedly, the gunman, from just a couple days ago, is running the show for Kroll. So to set this up, Russia in August 1998 defaulted on $40 billion U.S. worth of domestic bonds and effectively allowed the ruble to devalue very quickly. And the default on the bonds did a number on high-risk investors who were clinging and investing wildly in what was once a lucrative Russian bonds. And then the government prohibited the Russian banks paying any foreign claims, which basically made it impossible for international banks like Deutsche Bank, like Lehman Brothers, RIP Lehman Brothers, right? Remember them? time ran out for them. So they weren't able to get paid and collect on their currency hedges. And I think the money owed to all those 17 banks came to a little bit more than $1 billion. Now, you might say, oh, that's not a lot of money, but you have to say this is $1 billion, $1.3, $1.4 billion in 1999. So if you took $1.3 or $1.4 billion in 99 and you ran it through the inflation calculator, did all your calculations, you'd come up to with about, I think, the equivalent of $2 billion. So anybody who thinks $2 billion is chump change, you have to get your head examined. But that's in addition, again. That's what was owed to the banks. Okay. That doesn't include the $40, $50, $60 billion of domestic bonds that Moscow defaulted on, including U.S. bonds. And that's why the CIA and, of course, Washington, D.C. was very, very worried. So Deutsche Bank sued Russia's two biggest banks at the time, along with Lehman Brothers, Incombank, and they were trying to force themselves ahead of the line. I think of when the bank owes people money and there's a long line of people waiting to get their money. And if you're in the middle of the pack or you're behind the pack and there's not a big pie of money, you want to force yourself to the front of the line so that you have your hand out first and you can almost dictate as best as you can based on the available funds and manipulate things so you can try to get a lion's share to recover the money. So, again, it's really uncanny that this Hollander guy was involved in this Deutsche Bank case in 1999-2000 era. And then you read his name as gunning this person down, two people down, of course, and it's like no big deal. Oh, yeah, he was just a pissed off lawyer. Really? So if they're trying to sell this way, right, where's the real shooter at? And what did this Hollander guy know that made him kind of a dangerous guy? I mean, you have to look at all this stuff. A good investigator does his or her homework. You understand there are larger issues at play here. You got the government, Russia involved, you got Russian banks stiffing U.S. banks welching on U.S. bonds. The United States government's very concerned. And guess who was president at the time? You can't even make it up. Mr. Clinton. Okay. So you have all these concerns over there in Russia working to find the money, following the money, trying to find the money. And Hollanders is involved in that. No one else has reported that. Why? Isn't that kind of important? That he was working, whether directly, indirectly, whatever the hell, with Deutsche Bank, on behalf of Deutsche Bank investors, on behalf of the government of Russia, and liaisoning again with U.S. intel, including the Central Intelligence Agency. Isn't that important? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a few decades later, the guy supposedly shows up at a federal judge's house who is overseeing a class action lawsuit brought by Deutsche Bank investors who believe that the bank failed to properly monitor customers. And the bank itself was deemed to be high risk, including, among others, a convicted sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein, and his friends. Nobody sees that that's a problem. That this, I guess it doesn't even matter anymore. Who in the media is actually going to report anything on it? Nobody. That's my guess. And a guy like Hollander just happens to be over in Moscow working with Boris Yeltsin. Okay, the president of Russia. And also involved is Putin. How is Putin involved? Okay, well, let's talk about it. And then we'll jump back into some stuff. Now, we're talking about raw intelligence, so I'm going to jump around here a little bit. Try to keep up. Try to keep up. So let's just do a quick timeline. Yeltsin is president of Russia from 91 to 99. So he's president December 31st, 99, I think, is when he stepped down. Who was he? Oh, man. Let me get the dates right. Who was he succeeded by? Vladimir Putin. Now, Yeltsin was trying to take Putin out, literally. That's why one of the reasons he hired Kroll Associates, who was, again, in Moscow, headed by this alleged gunman, Hollander, of the federal judge's family. Doesn't this sound less and less convincing as the more I talk about it? It sounds less and less plausible that this guy actually lashed out. Or if he did, why aren't these associations being discussed in the media? Okay. If the guy is the actual gunman, what is this case really about? I'll tell you what it's about. It's about money. That's what it's about. So Yeltsin says, hey, Kroll Associates, come on over here and help us find as much money as you can from these tucked away from these banks and offshore accounts from crooked politicians who use the bank to launder money because we want to get a piece of that too. Let us know what's in the Grand Caymans. Let us know what's in Luxembourg. Let us know what's in Liechtenstein and all these other tax havens that we can't directly get our hands on. But Yeltsin, you know, with the power of the pulpit over there as president of Russia, would be able to recover these funds and help make help make a lot of these financial institutions a whole. In addition to alleviating some of the political pressure on himself. So he has Kroll come in, literally has them come in and work basically for him. And then they're also working de facto or directly or whatever for Deutsche Bank, who leads, again, this consortium of all the banks that have been stiffed, including Lehman Brothers and many others. And many in the U.S. Okay, so we have to go back to the early 1990s to examine what's going on here. in the early 1990s in Russia, billions of dollars flowed overseas from Russia, and the funds came from a variety of places, including basically illegal KGB accounts. They went offshore, people who were stealing money and resources from Russia, and accounts by people who belonged to the Committee for Foreign Economic Relations, CFER, in Russia. So a problematic group at the time, kind of a shadowy group. So all these dollars were flowing overseas from Russia. That include organized crime, receipts of sales for Russian merchandise, counterfeit goods, bought low in the domestic market and sold for a higher price internationally. It's alleged that the Kali cartel was laundering money through these banks and then stuffing them in offshore accounts. So you have all this stuff going on, right? And President Yeltsin at the time brings in the American investigative firm Kroll to get a handle on where the money has gone, where it is, and try to claw it back, try to repatriate the money that was illegally held in other parts of the world or shipped overseas by former Communist Party and Soviet government agencies, including the KGB. And for folks who have been living under a rock for a long time, Mr. Putin is former KGB, big time. So what were they looking for, right? All this money, you're talking about 40, 50, 60 billion dollar range in untaxed revenue that had been leaked out of Russia. And Kroll, what they did, and again, Hollander, the alleged gunman of the federal judge's family, was running the show there at the time, or soon after Kroll was brought in to do this, but Kroll uncovered literally hundreds of offshore bank accounts set up by former Soviet officials, KGB guys, etc. The same kind of stuff we're talking about. At the Putin at the time was the person to know in St. Petersburg. And while Yeltsin was trying to put enough evidence together to really marginalize Putin, Putin was trying to run out the clock, and then eventually he was very successful at this. He was never prosecuted because, obviously, because he became president right after Yeltsin. So he ran out the clock. A lot like Bill Barr's running out the clock now for all of his CIA, FBI buddies who will not be prosecuted, in my estimation. This is an old game. People new to politics or following politics haven't really followed them in the last, let's say, 20 years. And you're listening to people out there saying people are going to jail. You don't understand the long game. This just goes back to the long game. So the rub is on this with what Kroll was looking for and trying to locate. Yeltsin passed a law giving Russia the right to confiscate funds if they were illegally taken outside the country. Right? So we're talking about organized crime, counterfeit weapons, all kinds of things, right? If the funds were generated through illegality, the Russian government could confiscate the funds. If the money left Russia legally, the government couldn't get to it. So, before he became president of Russia, Putin was the man in St. Petersburg. And if someone issued you a license, okay, to say that you were legally transferring money and exporting goods out of Russia, and they signed a license, then the government wasn't able to say that the money was generated illegally and then they couldn't confiscate it. So here comes Deputy Mayor Putin of St. Petersburg, who signed thousands of licenses and contracts and legalized a massive amount of exports and transfers. And it ultimately came down that, you know, he was being paid behind the scenes to basically license theft and crime and give these folks a get out of jail free card that the proceeds from the illicit profits could not be confiscated by the Russian government. Then you have Kroll and Hollander in there locating all these offshore bank accounts. It's like a cat and mouse game at the time. I'm pulling from an article here. I linked some of these articles that are interesting. It says an investigation into Putin's activities by the St. Petersburg City Council concluded that Putin had signed contracts before being officially authorized to do so, and that the terms that included payment of substantial commissions between 25 and 50% for each contract and license he endorsed. There was a legislative report reading from that. I'm not sure if it's online anymore, but so he's getting kickbacks. He's signing these licenses together, and this is insane. But what does this have to do with anything? Well, it all dovetails with everything else we're talking about. This is all happening at the same time, okay? And don't forget where Deutsche Bank is a German bank, okay? And Putin was also implicated in a criminal investigation at the time by German authorities into the St. Petersburg real estate holding company called SPAG, S-P-A-G. The Germans charged that SPAG had used similar schemes to launder money out of and into St. Petersburg from a variety of sources, including the Kali cartel. As I said earlier, the Kali cartel is alleged to be involved with this. Putin was a member of the SPAG advisory board, and his name on the masthead attracted Western investors to St. Petersburg. It's alleged that Putin provided protection for his co-conspirators when contracts were not fulfilled, and though legal actions were taken against SPAG, none of the Russian participants were indicted. It goes on and on and on. This guy is untouchable. And so we frame that. I think we've done a good job of framing that right now. And this goes on. I mean, talking about Putin, St. Petersburg, that goes back to 1990 when Putin became an advisor of, who's the mayor? Anatoly Sobchak, I think his name was. And then Putin became deputy mayor and head of the Committee for Foreign Economic Relations, CFER. Remember, we talked about them a few minutes ago. The function of the committee was to encourage, regulate, and license the establishment of foreign trade in and by St. Petersburg. Officials in Moscow granted Putin the authorization to issue licenses and contracts to conduct foreign trade. All this was going on at the time. President Boris Yeltsin hired Kroll to come over and start finding this offshore money so they could try to get a piece of it, since the banks had fleeced everybody. The banks were running schemes based on the same exact tenets I'm talking here about Deputy Mayor Putin. Deputy Mayor Putin was running and issuing licenses and getting kickbacks and funneling funds offshore. So Yeltsin brings in Kroll. He wants to know where the banks are. Hollander, the alleged gunman, is working on behalf through Kroll in Moscow to do that. Again, similarly or parallelly working with and on behalf of this 17-bank consortium led by Deutsche Bank. They pull their information, they share it with United States intelligence apparatus, including a central intelligence agency. And this is your alleged supposed gunman. And what just happened? Or Patsy. Because you knew too much about something else. Maybe you knew too much about those offshore accounts and where the money is. Where everybody's money was at the time and probably still is. So when you're talking about the current case, and I hope I've done a good enough job of framing it. There's just so much intel coming in on this. And you know, you have to go back and look at it from a time perspective. I try to explain it to everybody. You know, you're dealing with... Well, I forgot to mention the other bank that Lehman and Deutsche sued was Unexim Bank, along with Incom Bank, and they were two of Russia's biggest banks that defaulted on obligations of more than who knows how much money. $2 billion? That's not even the bonds. That's just cash. Other banks involved. Let me see some of the other banks involved. Credit Suisse, First Boston, of course, Deutsche Bank. And they were trying to salvage anything they could from the investments that collapsed after the government defaulted on $40 billion in debts, U.S. in debts in 1998. That kind of leaves the Russian banks, who are the biggest holders of the government bonds, holding the bag. It's insane. I'm reading from an old newspaper article over here. It says the Russian government's creditors also are trying to recover whatever they can. A delegation led by Deutsche Bank, representing 17 foreign banks, is meeting the government in Moscow today. This is from September 1998. And that cooperation continued for at least 2 years or more, looks like. When our friend, Mr. Roy Dan Hollander, was running operations for Kroll Associates in Moscow at the same time and liaisoning with the Central Intelligence Agency and Deutsche Bank and places like we talked about, Credit Suisse, First Boston, 14 other banks, many in the U.S., and there you have it. If you wanted to sum all this up, well, let me look at, I guess, some more notes here. Let me just throw this out at you. And we'll continue to develop this because it's very interesting. That's this initial story in a nutshell. We will continue to develop it, see what else we can come up with on Mr. Roy Dan Hollander. But no one else is telling you that he worked with the CIA and he worked with Deutsche Bank a long time ago. And how does that play into what just happened? What did he know? What did he find out when he was working over there, looking at all these offshore accounts? People all around the world were profiting from this. You talk about international trafficking of children and abuse of children and networks. What did Mr. Hollander know? He came across being in the belly of the beast in Moscow, looking at Russian banks. The time when it was the Wild West. People all over the world could use Russian banks to launder money. It's really fucking frightening. And I was hoping when we started to talk to people, there would be nothing there. It's just some maniac who showed up on the judge's door and started firing a gun. I mean, these things can happen organically, although they are rare, but they can happen. And instead, I left scratching my head thinking, did this Roy Dan Hollander even leave the house that day? Or did somebody just barrel in the house and gun him down? I guess you could call these things a conspiracy theory, but when you really go back in time, and look at the puzzle pieces, there's some disturbing questions that need to be answered here. Now, who's going to answer them, guys? The FBI? Give me a fucking break. You think the CIA is going to talk about this stuff? You think the FBI is going to talk about this stuff? You think the people who have money, they use the Russian banks to launder money, whether it's countries, not just people, okay? You're talking about countries, talking about drugs, Cali cartel. Well, if the Cali cartel is in there, you can guarantee you that there are other illicit drug cartels worldwide. Okay, whether it's in Asia, whether it's another one in Colombia, okay, Mr. Escobar's cartel, okay? Medellin? And that's just drugs. We're not even talking about weapons. I'm talking about moving weapons around the world. What about kids? What about trafficking kids? See how this plays together? Epstein, we know, was a massive global player in extortion, blackmail. Where was his money? Is his money coming through Russia? Is he using Russia to launder money? Launder kids? Traffic kids? And a guy like Hollander? He gets to see all this stuff? Why haven't we been told about this first? Oh, it's just some kook. Just some kook from New Jersey that went off the reservation, right? I think after listening to this podcast, Thomas Paine podcast number 33, and I apologize if parts of this have been choppy, but it's coming in. It's coming in all day long. I want to get it out. So I'm sorry if it doesn't read like your favorite. What's the name of that weirdo who flies around on a fucking broom? Not Hillary Clinton. Harry Potter. I'm sorry if it doesn't read like your favorite Harry Potter novel, but this is raw intel coming through, and it's important to get it out the door. We'll follow up on it. But for now, I would characterize this as blockbuster intel. And again, when you work at the same time frame in the same markets and you have clients who are all at play here, I was fortunate to have good clients when I was working with my intel group and I was leading my intel group. You understand really the landscape of what is at play here. And Kroll is no joke. These guys are fucking heavyweights. The question is, what did Hollander see during that time, and what did he know? That's my question. Who was worried about a guy like Hollander to knock him off? I don't think he did this himself. And I think I just laid out a pretty goddamn convincing case, even though it's preliminary, that could sway a jury otherwise. So it's a hell of an episode, and I appreciate all the folks behind the scenes who put work together on this for us and reaching out to some of my old folks. One of the tenets I've always had in intel is never burn a bridge. Even if you owe somebody money or you get into some kind of financial squabble back in the day, it's always better just to pay them what they're owed, because you can always use those folks down the road. You don't want to piss off or burn bridges in intel. And that is something that has served me very well through decades, and it allows me to pick up the phone and talk to people and reach back 20, 30 years when needed. So, and that's what we're doing here. We are back 21 years and we're able to put together a pretty good beyond a snapshot of what the hell's going on here. If you think, after listening to this, if you think this is just some random kook who showed up on the judge's doorstep with a gun, you should perhaps listen to this again. So we'll wrap that up. Number 33 is an epic one. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of our work on it. And we appreciate, you know, if you find some useful intel in this, which I think you will, and and you want to show us a sign of appreciation, we do appreciate the support on patreon.com/truepundit and subscribestar.com/truepundit. And our subscriber-only areas will get the video podcasts of the Pain in the Morning and the More Pain Show, and we appreciate the support on there. It helps us do these things. And I thought we'd come back from Florida and maybe kind of take it easy this week, but that has not been the case after what happened in North Jersey, my old haunt. I'm a Rutgers graduate as well in journalism school. I actually went to school for journalism. Some people who got their education and license in Cracker Jack box, so apparently. So, good stuff. We look forward to Pain in the Morning tomorrow, and I hope... I say at the end of every show, take care and God bless, and I really mean it, because we need some divine intervention in our lives here. There's so many different narratives and schemes at play here by evil people. And you see that with this Roy Den Hollander. Okay. I mean, you're talking about, I've said this a number of times, I'm not going to harp on it, the haves versus the have-nots. The have-nots are always at risk of being eliminated by the haves. And I think you could say that, and I'm making some leaps here, I understand that, but I understand where this story is going, I think. The have-not, like Mr. Hollander, certainly becomes a dangerous guy if he has a lot of dirt on the haves. And he becomes, I think, no different than a person like Maxwell herself or Epstein. If you get to see a glimpse into this stuff and you think that this Hollander guy is a loose end, if the haves think a Hollander type is a loose end, well, they're going to make sure that he gets eliminated, and anybody who tries to bring his name up who might have, you know, oh, well, this guy told me this happened. It's like, the guy who killed the federal judge's kid and tried to kill the judge and the husband, that guy? The guy was a kook. And hence the insulation by the haves. You have to put all this stuff together like a puzzle piece and think outside the box a lot of times to try to understand what's happening. But I think we're on to something here, as we usually are. And I'm sure that the FBI is not happy about this broadcast, but that's life. That is life. And again, I'm fortunate to have been in the business at the time, in the same exact neighborhood with the same exact clients. And... to put the puzzle pieces together, to talk to the right people and get a real good 30,000-foot view of what's going on here instead of listening to the bullshit that the ABCs, CBSs, Fox News are trying to feed us on this story. It doesn't make any sense. It never did from minute one. Take care and God bless.
in the USSR. In the USSR.